All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuckadelics? What's happening? My name's Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. It's been my podcast, WTF, for almost a decade. Since 2009, folks. How's it going? Are you all right? How you holding up in the heat? It's bad, right? It's like end of the world bad, right? It's like, oh man, we fucked it up bad, isn't it? Or maybe you're of the other way of thinking. Nah, it's just, this happens. It's happened before. No, it hasn't. I think it was 175 degrees in Detroit. Maybe I'm exaggerating. I think it was 192 in Scottsdale, Arizona. Am I off? I think it might have broke 200. It might have broke 200 in Maine. That seems worrisome. I think it was 212 degrees in Florida, but you have the ocean, so it's nice. You just have to wear a sunblock, maybe use paint. Yeah, maybe you should just use some kind of a ceramic coating for yourself. So look, Gina Davis is on the show today. Gina Davis is, I don't use this word a lot, but I hung around with Ira Glass for a few minutes and he uses it a while back. Wonderful. Gina Davis is wonderful. She's in Glow. She's in the new season of Glow, which I think premieres August 9th, I believe. But she has a lot more important things going on, to be quite honest with you. She'll be receiving the Jean Hersholt Humanitarian Award by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences at this year's Governor's Awards Ceremony. She's got that going on. And she executive produced the documentary, This Changes Everything. It will have a one-night only showing across the country tonight, July 22nd, before going out into theaters and on demand on August 9th. This documentary blew my mind, changed my mind, changed my life. You know, it's as some of you have gleaned from my disposition, I seem to be putting a lot of new things in the head, opening the heart a little bit, understanding my part in things, and understanding the way the world works. It's a painful process, you know, especially because the world is ending. It's sad that a lot of us are going to be kind of coming into our own and understanding how, you know, what's really happening and how we can help. And then it's just going to burn up. It was 272 degrees in St. Louis last night. Yeah, I'm not kidding. Your pool better be cold. You better have some ice cubes in the pool because it was almost 300 degrees in San Francisco. Yeah, don't even talk about Texas. It was up around 390. Thank God for the suits, right? The heat suits that we have now. Thank God. Yeah, there's not a lot of vegetation to look at. It's just kind of a baked landscape with cracks and stuff. Few lizards lived. Yeah, some other weird new bugs, some large spiders. Basically, what they used to have in Australia is all the wildlife we have in the continent now. Just large spiders, fucked up snakes, and yeah. And then there are the strange people that have adapted and grown scales. They're disconcerting. But hey, you know, it's good that we have our cooled down apartments and we have our heat suits and we can go out into the 382 degree weather in Houston. It's all right. It's going to be okay. Look. Oh, God. Sword of Trust. Sword of Trust, the movie I'm in, the movie that Lynn Shelton directed, it's spreading. We're spreading to theaters. It's like viral. We're now up to more than 70 theaters across the country showing the movie Sword of Trust this summer. Go to swordoftrust.com to check out if it's going to be playing near you. This Friday, it expands to more than 20 new cities, including Atlanta, Philadelphia, Seattle, and Portland, Oregon. Also, I will be at the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal, where it is now just under 362 degrees. That's this weekend. I'll be in Montreal. And next week, starting Thursday, August 1st, I'll be at Good Nights in Raleigh, North Carolina, where it was a comfortable 194 degrees yesterday. No problem. Water rising. My brother was in town. I have a brother. I have a little brother. And we had a nice time. And again, something's happening. Something's happening to my heart. I'm telling you. He just came out for the weekend. You know, he called me a few weeks ago and he was like, why don't we hang out? We're brothers. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, we should. But he lives in Phoenix. I live here. And it was just one of those things. It's like, Why are we not? He said, I just feel like hanging out with you. And I'm like, that sounds good. So he came out and we just spent the weekend together, had some nice food. It was so great. It was so great. Cause I don't know. You know, it's rare that you, like, even if my mom comes here, which she did once, it wasn't bad, but I don't know what to do with my mom after an hour. Do you? But you do. You hang out, you do this, you go, you shop, you do whatever you're going to do. But it's my bro. It's my brother Craig. He came out and we just, you know, we literally sat in the car and listened to jazz for like a half hour before one of the screenings of Sword of Trust, had a bite to eat, got up, cooked some food, sat around, listened to music, talked about whatever, just no distance, no, you know, just brothers, man. And we just kind of, we took a walk, we took a hike, and we just talked, no pressure, brothers, my brother, and I love him. And he's a nice guy. He's nicer than me. It's weird because we're brothers, and I don't know what your sibling relationship is, but I look at him, I see myself, we got the same drive shaft, the same wiring, but somehow or another, he fought the good fight with himself, and he's a nicer guy. You know, things are heavy for him, and things are heavy for me sometimes, but generally, you know, I'm a little defensive first. He's always nice. I introduce him to friends of mine, and they're like, he's really nice, and of course, I'm like, what are you saying? What does that mean? What does it mean that my brother's nice? What about me? You're all right. All right, I get it. He's like a nice version of me. It's an inspiration. It's an inspiration. So this Gina Davis conversation, I watched the documentary. I didn't know what it was. I just recently worked with Gina Davis. I love Gina Davis. Who doesn't love Gina Davis? But I watched a documentary called This Changes Everything. And it's really about equal opportunity, equal pay in show business. It's about the struggle women have in that business and in general, and what really the product of show business is and how it represents women. It kind of focuses a bit on young girls and what they're taking in when you limit the presence of women or limit the characters of women or limit the actual women that can do the work behind the camera, in front of the camera, that why wouldn't young girls watching it sort of contextualize the world like that? Well, the world has been like that. And I'm in the process of educating myself and being educated. And that was it's really mind-blowing because Gina put together this, I don't know if it's a foundation or what you would call it, to do the research, to really get data on representation of women on screen, on camera, and also obviously in, you know, writing rooms and directors. But that's easier to get that data. But to really, she had people sort of sit down with all the movies and just make notes. And the data is disturbing. And I'll talk to her about it, but it was, I've been talking to a lot of very powerful, but informative women on this show recently, and it is helping me, and I hope the conversations are helping you. I do, and I'm not, again, this is not what you would call virtue signaling. This is a person re-educating himself in the proper way, okay? So the documentary, This Changes Everything, will have a one-night-only showing across the country tonight. This is July 22nd, before going out into theaters and on demand on August 9th. And that's also the day Glow Season 3 premieres on Netflix, so you can watch me and Gina in that. And also she'll be receiving, as I said at the beginning, the Jean Hersholt Humanitarian Award by the Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts, and Sciences at this year's Governor's Awards Ceremony. And she deserves it. The work she's been doing, she's just great. She's just great, and I talked to her. And now you can listen to us talk. Now. Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer, and I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago. Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF.
Did you have fun doing that show?
I did, yeah. I had a good time.
Wild,
you
right?
guys are great, yeah.
I know, it was weird this season because we're all, and I can't spoil anything, I don't think, but we're all sort of off doing our own lives.
Right.
So I missed all of that, the singing, the show. Like, I wasn't there.
Oh, right.
So I got to wait. I have to wait to see it.
I have to watch
yeah.
it. Yeah.
But that was good. I was so happy you were part of it.
Yeah, it was really fun. You guys are great.
Yeah, yeah, they're all so, it's crazy.
Yeah,
in
it's
Vegas.
Crazy.
Did it get crazier? I feel like I missed everything. I can't, now I feel we're into the spoiler territory.
Yeah, yeah.
So I watched a doc last night. This changes everything.
You did, cool.
Well, it would have been pretty awful if you showed up and go like, no, I didn't really have time to watch your little lady thing. You know, hopefully I'll be able to get it. Well, you know, I'll try to fit it in at some other point, but we can talk about it anyways.
That lady thing, yeah. Right.
Yeah, it seemed pretty interesting. I just, you know, I hope you guys work it out. But I found it, you know, being, somebody, what's interesting is I've been talking about this a lot lately because I talked to Eve Ensler and I've been talking about it in my stand-up as well about my generation of men. And I was keeping it specific that, like, I'm 55. So I would say things like, you know, my generation of men, you know, really needed this waking or this education. But it really turns out culturally that I think that the documentary shows very specifically that it's not in any way that men are victims here in the sense that we all got the same information.
Right.
So, like, the patriarchy or the cultural sexism was not my generation. It's something that all of us
right.
grew up with.
Absolutely.
Right. So there's, like, you know, for me, like, I made this assumption somehow that, well, there's this younger generation of the evolved dudes
right.
that are, you know, are sensitive to all these things. And it's not true that all generations, and you prove it fairly specifically,
right.
were brought up with this cultural education and institutional education. And it just broadened, you know, what I was already sort of dealing with and trying to wrap my head around
right.
into a more common experience. That, like, there's no men that get off the hook in terms of what they grew up in. There's no, like, maybe some are more evolved than others and more sensitive.
Yeah.
But we're all getting the same information.
Right, right.
So we're all sort of, that was the ocean white male entitled fish were swimming in.
Right.
Right?
That's true, yeah.
But when you look back, I guess, you know, because I want to talk about the whole thing, but I think that your experience, you know, as a woman, and obviously, you know, a lot of this starts with, you know, what are young girls taking in.
Right.
You know, because, you know, this industry dictates the cultural narrative in a lot of ways.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Right.
But when you look back at your own life starting out, are there things that you frame as regrets?
No, I don't. I wish that I was... that I became woke a lot sooner, you know, because, you know, we're getting the same message as the men that,
right.
that I mean, which is frankly that women are second class citizens, but, you know, nobody realized that.
Right. Women didn't.
Women, yeah. And I don't think men did either. I don't think consciously they thought, well, women are second class citizens. I don't know.
It was just the way things were.
Just kind of the way things were.
Yeah, there's a sort of weird, sort of established historical codependency.
Right. Right. Exactly.
and that's being, you know, probably trivializing it. Actually, it's worse than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so I wish I'd noticed things sooner. And partly, for me, one of the biggest things was learning that it's okay to speak up. And stand up for yourself. You know, I was raised in a very, very specific way.
Where?
In Massachusetts, small town.
What part?
Wareham. It's right near the Cape.
Yeah, I know. I started my career there and doing one-nighters all over the Cape.
Oh, no way.
And all over Massachusetts.
That's cool.
So I'm familiar with those towns.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the ones that are closer to Boston, some of them are pretty dicey.
Yeah. Yeah. True.
But how were you brought up?
Well, to be that being polite was the number one most important thing in the world, to have people like you and not cause any waves and have no needs.
Right.
In fact, I keep thinking if I wrote a book, a title would be "I Almost Died of Politeness" or something like
right.
that. Because I'll tell you the funny story. When I was a little kid, I had an uncle that was 99, and we went to dinner with him. My parents and I went to dinner with my uncle,
the 99-year-old uncle,
and his wife, and he drove.
Yeah.
When we were driving back, he kept kind of veering into the oncoming traffic lane and then veering back and veering
right,
in.
Right.
And it was all kind of okay, but scary. And my mom, I was on the behind the driver. She picked me up and put me in the middle of the two of them so that when we died, I would die a little bit less. and then he veered into the oncoming traffic lane and stayed there. And we were about to have a head-on collision. And nobody said anything. My parents didn't say anything.
Yeah.
And it was literally like, we're going to die in 1 second.
Yeah.
And finally, his wife said, "A little to the right, Jack." And he veered right. And I still remember the faces of the people with the horror on their faces as they
Thank God she stepped in.
Inches away. Right. But my parents would have rather die and kill me than say, steer right.
Yeah.
Jack. Or even very politely, like she said, maybe a little bit to the right, Jack.
but when they got home, did either of them go like, why is he still driving?
No. No.
What did they do, your parents?
My dad was in the Corps of Engineers his whole life. Mm. And my mom was a teacher's aide and worked in as a nursing home craft person and was a waitress in a restaurant. She always had some kind of job going on.
And was it a religious thing or just a New England thing? Or like the politeness and the kind of, I mean, how were you brought up in that way?
I don't know if it was.
I guess it's not inherently religious. I just wonder like.
They were very religious, but it was something about, and also having no needs from anybody else. You absolutely don't need anything from anybody.
Sure.
Like when I went to a friend's house to play, I couldn't eat or drink anything. Like even if they were handing you an ice cold glass of water that they already poured, I had to say, no thanks, I'm not thirsty.
That's polite.
Yes, evidently.
Yeah.
It was weird. So I grew up never thinking about my opinions of anything, that I just should go along and try to make sure that everybody really, really liked me. And I drove, when I dated, I drove guys crazy because they'd say, what do you want to eat? I don't know, whatever.
Yeah. Nothing.
Where do you want to go? Nothing, really. No, I don't want to. And it would finally be like, oh my God, will you just say what you want?
Yeah.
So I entered the business with that kind of mindset, and so there was never any question that I was going to say, can we change this line, or I don't want to do that,
right,
or something like that.
But when you started, when you're in Wareham, when did you start getting interested in expressing yourself in acting, or because you do a lot of things? I mean, you play instruments, you shoot arrows, you act. Yeah, and now you're an activist.
Right.
But what was the first thing?
Well, my parents said I told them when I was 3 that I wanted to be in movies.
Yeah.
And I can't even, what would I have seen? How would I know that was a job even, but
you probably saw some kid that was having a good time.
I saw something. I don't know. So anyway, that was it. That was it. It was either that, or I also was attracted to wrapping presents in a department store. I thought that was like the coolest job ever.
Around the same time, I'm hoping.
Yeah.
I hope that one drifted to the wayside.
It did.
You know, by about five.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So did you act in high school and all the way through it?
No, I kind of kept it to myself. It was kind of like this thing I was going to do once I left.
No arts?
Well, music and art, you know. Yeah. I was really into drawing and painting and stuff like that.
What'd you play?
Flute, piano, and pipe organ.
Do you play any of them still?
Not regularly, though.
Pipe organ?
Yeah, well, because my piano teacher was also the organist at our church.
Yeah.
And so she taught me how to play the organ. And then when they had an early youth service at church, I played the organ. So.
That's a powerful feeling.
It was
playing
fun.
A big pipe organ.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Wow. So when did you actively start doing it, the acting?
I decided I was going to study it in college.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know there were schools you could go where it was only acting. I would have gone there. But I asked my music teacher, where do people go if they want to study acting? And he said, oh, Boston University. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's where I went.
Yeah, in School of the Arts?
Yeah.
I went to BU.
You did?
Yeah.
What did you study?
I was in the English department, but I took classes up there.
Yeah.
You know, with Bill Young, I think his name
was.
Oh,
yeah, Bill Young. He was my teacher, yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, what do you know?
He was kind of intense.
He was pretty intense.
Yeah.
He was cool, though. I liked him.
So it was like, it's become a pretty good program. Was it good when you were there?
It has become a great program. It was good. They, there was very little emphasis on film acting or television acting. Was all about theater.
Yeah.
And I think they sort of looked down on anything besides theater.
Right.
And
right.
So I kind of felt out of place.
Like this is
really.
The nuts and bolts of it.
Right.
You can do whatever you want with it after, but don't talk to us about it.
Right. Yeah.
We're giving
yeah.
you the pure stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, so I felt a little bit out of place. And then, they never said if you want to go into movies, you should go to L.A. Nobody ever said that. So I went to New York with everybody else. Everybody went to New
for
York
theater.
After school for
Who,
theater.
Was anyone else in your class that we know?
Well, Nina Tassler was the, what did she end up being? Chairman of CBS
mm-hmm.
for about 10 years. And she's my best friend. And we went to school
Oh, you
together.
Were together?
Yeah.
She was in the acting program?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I always find that interesting that there are people like in comedy as well. Who, you know, they have a skill set or they learn the skill set, but they don't always end up in that position in the business.
Right.
You know, like a lot of comics end up actors or producers or, you know, some, but like, you know, she's in show business.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Did she used to direct or do any of that stuff before or was it
no.
like, did she just go the business route after?
She went the business route.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
She was like, this acting is not going to do it. I ain't going to make a break on this one.
I guess.
It's tough, right?
It is.
So you go to New York?
Yeah, I went to New York.
Scrambled around.
I didn't know how I was supposed to get in a movie. So I had this idea because, what's her name, Christie Brinkley was getting offered movie parts and Lauren Hutton too.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, okay, I'll just become a model and then they'll just ask me to act.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's so much easier to become a supermodel.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Good plan B.
Yeah. It's my backup plan. But anyway, I did become a model. I didn't have that kind of a success. I was on the cover of New Jersey Monthly, though.
Good for you.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you have that framed at home?
I had a... You know, I don't. I should have it up on the wall. Because my face doesn't even show.
Oh, really?
I'm in a bathing suit with a hat over my face.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah. Anyway, but I did get cast in Tootsie from being a model. The part required the character to be in her underwear a lot, and they figured, let's see if there's any models.
Comfortably in her underwear.
Who can act. Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. Just very comfortable. And so they called my agency. And they said, we have a model who can act. And I tried out for the, I read for the part, just, you know, put it on tape or whatever with the casting assistant.
Uh-huh.
And they had said, wear a bathing suit under your clothes. And if you read well, they'll want to see you in a bathing suit because, you know, the part. And so I went and I had a bathing suit on under my clothes. But they never said, can we see your bathing suit? So I put it completely out of my mind. What are the odds my first audition, I'm going to get a part with Dustin Hoffman? You know,
right.
I mean, that's ridiculous.
And what are the odds you're going to get a part where you don't have to take your clothes off?
Right.
Like in the audition. You know?
Right, right, right. You did. Exactly.
And you got it.
But then I got it because I was in Paris when they said, hey, we like this girl. Where's her bathing suit? Stuff. And I said, oh, we forgot. Get her back. Oh, no, she's in Paris. Well, do they have any photos of her in a bathing suit? And I had been in a Victoria's Secret catalog.
I thought you were going to say the cover of New Jersey Magazine.
Yeah, well, they could have said that. Yeah. But yeah, they sent them the Victoria's Secret catalog and they were like, okay, look at her.
And okay, so like, okay, in retrospect, you know, in terms of, because my first wife was a model and and that was the trajectory she was on. Now, are you noticing, you know, this sort of like, you know, the propensity towards objectification completely? I mean, did you have any reaction to that experience, you know, as somebody who was in that business?
Right. No.
Because you didn't frame it that way.
I didn't frame it that way.
You were living within the patriarchal framework.
Exactly.
That was just life.
Right.
That was the ocean that we were all swimming
exactly.
in.
Exactly. That's right. That's right.
And you had what you wanted to do and it was starting to manifest.
Right.
So
that's right.
It was not, there was no injustice to the system. It worked quite well for you in that moment.
It did. You're right. I never thought about that.
So, so the experience of working with Hoffman and Pollock, was that?
Oh, my God. So yeah. Fabulous.
Was it?
So,
I can't imagine.
It was so great. So this funny thing happened because obviously I'd never been on a set before and I was terrified they were going to say, well, she doesn't know what to do or right. where to stand and everything. So I never asked any questions.
Right.
And
But your upbringing as well, right?
Right, of course. Yeah. So nobody ever told me you don't have to come every day. You just have to come the days you're
when
working.
When you're on the sheet, you weren't looking
when you're
at
on
the
call sheet.
Sheet. Right.
No. So I came every day, all day.
You showed up for work.
I showed up for work.
You had a job.
And nobody ever said, you know, it's interesting that you come every, you know, I guess they, I don't know what, they
did
just assume. And I would get a chair and put it right next to Sidney Pollack and
really?
Sit next to him all day.
And just watch?
I just, like, here we
and
are.
And no one said anything?
Here we are making this movie. No, he loved it. He was kind of always like,
Was it you must have learned that way.
I did.
Even if it was a mistake, at least you were like getting a class. You were a class.
I did. And Dustin took me to dailies every day.
He did?
Yeah, which was fantastic. He said, you got to learn how to, you know, what you think you're doing, is it translating onto screen?
So, oh, that's amazing. So yeah. that was the advanced course you were looking for. That was the course in college that you didn't get.
Exactly.
Let's look at what you did. Did he give you direction?
Yeah.
Dustin did?
He did too, yeah.
About acting?
Sure, yeah, uh-huh. About everything. About
oh, really?
Life. When you go to L.A., when you know...
Was he decent?
Oh, yeah. No, he was. He was to me, for sure, yeah. I didn't, yeah.
That's nice.
I know. It was great.
And Pollock, like, what, you know, I love that guy.
I love Sidney. Oh, my God.
And what was it like? What did you guys talk about?
Oh, he was genius. It was such an education to watch him direct. We talked about everything. And he, you know, it was famously sort of a difficult shoot, I think, for him that there had been a lot of writers and it was a lot of stress anyway. And he'd be rubbing his face with his hands, and I'd say, I think it's all going to be great. Yeah. Like, oh, okay, all right.
See, that politeness paid off.
Exactly.
Look at the chipper upbringing. It worked out. You saved Pollock's sanity.
Oh, there we go. That's why it happened. So I could save his sanity.
Well, I mean, but again, you know, in retrospect, that model is the one we're trying to shift a little bit.
Right.
that wasn't your role.
No, I didn't need to take that job.
But fortunately, you know, it was a great education.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And then how does it, like, and then what happens? Do you stop modeling?
Yeah. And then I got cast in a TV show from that, and then moved to L.A., and that was it. I started working.
Buffalo Bill?
Buffalo Bill, yeah. Because Dabney Coleman was in Tootsie, and he thought, oh, she'd be great in this part in my new show. So
Now what about Dabney? Good guy?
Oh, yeah. fantastic.
It's good. It's good. Like I, you know, I think sometimes it's like nice to hear nice stories about guys that play assholes. You know what I mean?
Right. Yes.
He was one of the great assholes on screen.
Exactly. Yeah.
But what was it? What was the transition to television like? Because like, what's interesting about like I think a lot of people associate you with movies.
Right.
And being, you know, having that presence for as long as you did, and the movies that you were in, which made a tremendous impact. But I mean, but you right at the beginning, you were like, I'll do TV, and you still don't mind doing TV.
No, I love TV. Yeah. I had a great time. I wanted to have a spin-off of it. You know, I had a lot of plans.
Of Buffalo Bill.
But, and then...
Was it on for a couple seasons?
Yes, two seasons.
Yeah.
And then I did a lot of guest spots on every show you can think of, like Fantasy Island and Knight Rider and all those crazy shows. Remington Steele.
Oh, good.
And everything. Yeah.
And so you're just working. And
just working.
And it was coming pretty steady.
Yep. Yeah, so it came pretty steady.
Where do you fit the archery in? When does that happen?
Oh, that wasn't until... Gosh, that was after Long Kiss Goodnight.
So after the craziness.
Yes. after the crazy patch.
You needed to focus.
Yes.
Yeah, on just a singular circle.
Exactly.
You got to get zen. So the next big film you do is The Fly?
Yeah. Yeah.
Whew, what a movie, huh?
That was my first lead part, and it was really intense. Yeah, it was so great.
Like Cronenberg, like it's interesting because like a lot of the movies, like that was, I would assume at that time, a fairly risky movie to do in terms of like it wasn't, it must have been some version of an independent movie on some point, or was it a big studio, this is a horror movie, we know what to do with this?
It was a Fox movie.
Yeah.
And Mel Brooks was the producer.
Oh, that's right.
Interestingly, yeah.
I think he produced The Elephant Man, too.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I talked to Mel. He's a good guy.
Such a great guy, yeah.
So he always had sort of like some weird kind of faith in, or the guy that who worked for him in these kind of like real, you know, singular kind of vision directors.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it was a big production.
So it was it did feel like a big production, and we loved it. Jeff and I just loved it.
Is that where you met him?
No, we met on Transylvania 65,000. You left that off.
I'm sorry. I really focus on the ones I remember enjoying and seeing.
Exactly.
What was Transylvania 65,000?
Oh, God. This crazy, awful, small movie that we shot in Yugoslavia.
In Yugoslavia?
Yes. That was crazy. I was a nymphomaniacal vampire in that.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, it was very strange. But that's where I met Jeff.
Yeah.
We were together 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like both of you really. I mean, there are certain people that whose personalities always sort of transcend whatever role they're in or what, like there's a natural intensity to the being.
Really? Me too?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Oh, okay.
No, you're singular. There's no doubt about it. you know what I mean? So, all right. So, The Fly, now Cronenberg, like, you know, obviously you being new to it, to the game with Pollock, you know, everything was eye-opening.
Right.
But working with somebody like Cronenberg, who has like a very specific and very peculiar vision and is sort of meticulous about, you know, how he captures it in almost all his movies, you know, what was the experience working with him?
Not really that different, you know.
Yeah.
He's incredibly confident and mm-hmm. calm and knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
Which, when I worked with more and different directors, I found out that that's not always the case, that you're not always this calm, focused genius who knows exactly what they're doing and is very comfortable if other people have ideas. You know, that's an important part of it.
Are you saying some of them are tyrannical madmen?
Well, possibly.
It's happened.
Uh-huh. But it seems to me that comes more out of insecurity, you know, that I have to be tyrannical because I'm scared of other people's ideas because I don't know quite what I'm doing and it all might go crazy.
Right.
So
they're trusting their own creative process is daunting.
Yeah.
Right.
Ridley Scott is like that too.
Yeah.
Exactly like that.
Right.
Just totally so comfortable,
knows
happy,
what he's doing.
Knows what he's doing. Yeah.
It really takes a certain type of person to direct. Cause like, you know, even like, you know, I'm friends with Lynn Shelton, who I don't know if she directed you on Glow.
Yes.
And she's very excited about the director element. Uh-huh. You know, in the movie, in the documentary, it resonated because she's a director.
Yeah,
just that moment where you have a woman director saying like she was denied the opportunity to create a body of work.
Right.
Yeah, like that's a very powerful thing to really put that into perspective. Mm-hmm. That you have these talented people that for no other reason than the systemic sexism. Ugh. Have all the talent and all the ideas and all of the wherewithal to execute and create a body of work that they don't have access.
Right.
Yeah, and it's powerful, disturbing stuff.
Yeah, it really is.
But back to like Cronenberg, because that's really a weird kind of a failed romance movie.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's how we looked at it, as sort of an operatic tragedy. And you know, David said it was really a metaphor for somebody having a fatal disease or something,
I definitely saw that. It's also, there is an element of profoundly toxic masculinity in the character, especially when he defends... You know, that moment where he defends, like, you're just trying to bring me down.
Right.
And he's like, able to climb on the ceiling.
Yeah.
This is amazing.
Right.
That moment's a great moment.
I can't believe you remember that.
Well, it's like, it's a profound moment, in any relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Where, especially somebody who is, bipolar or has found something their life... You know, it's like it's made them feel relevant and strong and everything has come together for them.
Yeah.
And how dare you?
Right.
You know, and meanwhile, he's got weird hairs growing out of his arm and things are falling off.
Yeah. His ear falls off.
Yeah. Oh. That was an amazing, vulnerable moment where he's like, oh. Like,
oh, yeah.
And he's putting stuff into the cabinet.
Yes. Oh, yeah. His teeth and things. So that moment, we thought that was a very... important moment where his ear falls off and oh my God, he realizes and I hug him and
He says, what's happening to me?
Yeah, what's happening to me? Yeah. It was very wonderful. And so Jeff and I went to Times Square opening night to watch the movie, stand in the back and watch the movie with people. And it was so great because all anybody's doing is saying, don't go in there, he's a fly, don't go in there. when that moment happened, which we thought was so tender and wonderful, people screamed and were talking so you couldn't hear the next two scenes. And it was because I hug him on the side where the ear fell off.
Yeah.
And so it was so gross,
Oh, they
goopy. Yeah. So I jam my face up against this goopy thing, and people were like,
that's hilarious.
We were like, oh, we should have thought.
I mean, no, it's good.
Yeah, I guess it's
a nice element. Right. It shows you really care.
I cared.
So, and then you go right into a more wackier horror movie.
I went right to Beetlejuice.
Another wildly independent, crazy thinking director.
Right, exactly. See, I got to work with some great directors.
Tim Burton,
yeah.
In his youth.
In his youth. Yep. When I met him,
yeah.
I said, listen, I want to be in this movie. I get this movie. Yeah. I just get it. I really picture it. And he said later, I hired her because she said she gets it.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure that I got it.
Right.
And so I thought at least somebody on the set, well, I could ask her if I get lost.
Like, I picture these. I'm glad these guys turned out to be good experiences. Like, and Kasdan directed The Accidental Tour?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he's another brilliant director. Very, just... comfortable in his skin and just knows what he's doing and knows what he wants.
And you feel yourself growing as an actress during all this?
Did
you study more when you were out here?
Yes, I did. So when I got cast in Accidental Tourist, I knew it was like a huge deal. And I thought I better get an acting coach to make sure I do a good job. And Gary Shandling, who I was friendly with, recommended Roy London.
Oh, yeah, I hear this name a lot, Roy London fella.
Yeah, yeah. He passed away, unfortunately, a little while back. But so I went to see him, and it was such a genius move. I worked with him on all my movies up until he passed away.
And what did he offer specifically?
So we would just, the two of us, sit down with the script and just go through every line, every scene, every moment, and figure out, you know, what is going on, what do I want, what am I trying to get, and it just helped me focus so much better instead of sort of just feeling it and acting it that way because you feel like that's the right thing to do, but really try to, what's the most interesting choice I can make here? And things like, this is a tiny example, but I made this movie Quick Change with Bill Murray, and there's a line, so we're trying to catch this plane, the whole movie's about we're trying to get to the airport, and at one point Randy Quaid, we see a plane take off, and Randy Quaid says, "Oh no, that was our plane, we missed our plane." And my line is, "No, if that was our plane, it would be crashing." And so my instinct would have been to say, "No, if it was our plane, it'd be crashing."
Yeah.
And he said, "What if you're trying to comfort him with this? You know, so I ended up saying, "No, if it was our plane, it would be crashing."
Right.
And it was just better and funnier. And
interesting.
So all that kind of finding the something that seems like the opposite of what's obvious, that your intention is almost always the opposite of what you're saying. Like if you're saying, "I hate you," you mean, "I love you." You know, that kind
right,
of,
right, yeah.
That's very simplistic, but yeah.
Oh, interesting. And because like it is kind of bizarre when you look at a script, just, you know, how much choice you have around that. I mean, there is a way it's written and you do have instincts around how to play it.
Right.
You know, but you know, with just like minor tweaks about where it comes from within you.
Right.
Can change the whole kind of tone of the conversation.
Right. Yeah. Right. And he also, well, this sort of fit with my personality too, because he kind of made, one of his goals was to make you director proof, that you know so well what you're doing that you're not going to get screwed up by direction. And so let's say I'm doing a scene, you know, where I'm very, very upset.
Yeah.
And then the director says, "No, I want you to do this scene very calm."
Yeah.
And so instead of throwing out what you're going to do, okay, now I'm very upset, but I'm trying to be calm.
Right, you know right. What I mean? Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you protect your choice by just making an adjustment.
Right. And then it turned out I don't have to talk to the director about, you know, I don't have to argue, "No, I want to play it this way."
Right, right.
You know what I mean?
I just work with a guy that like, he and I didn't mind it at all because I know I'm just sort of raw in a lot of ways. And I, you know, I come to the thing with a certain amount of energy, usually too much. So really with most directors, it's sort of like, "Could you just take that down?"
And yeah.
But like he would just literally say like, "I think this line is more like, blah, blah, blah." You know, like he would like give me a
line reading. Yeah.
But I could feel the emotion of it.
Right.
You know, and I'm like, "Oh, okay. Yeah. I can do my version of what you just, of the emotion you were expressing."
Yeah. Yeah. I don't mind when directors do that.
No, do me a favor.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you, I'm not, like, I'm that committed. It's like, "No, I'm going to, let's really run the, you know, I know actors do that all the time. I did.
Right.
Like, I guess I'm so, you know, grateful and sort of like insecure enough to not become, you know, that guy. Like I sometimes I don't understand how some of these bigger stars become monsters. I don't know how they live with it.
How do they become monsters?
Well, I kind of understand that, but still, like, I always give people the benefit of the doubt. But you know, people are like, "I'm not fucking getting out of this trailer until you get me these shoes."
Oh, it's God. Like,
you know, and it's like it happens a lot.
Oh God, it does.
And it's like, and it's another thing that they like, not unlike. Well, it's unlike it, but the kind of stuff that the industry absorbs and coddles is, you know, in the name of bottom line or just habit is kind of profound.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, entire productions are revolving, you know, economically and time wise and with so many people involved around a guy in a trailer throwing a shit fit.
Right.
It's crazy.
It's crazy.
It's it like, just really do your fucking job.
I've run into that.
Right? But I guess you get to a certain pay grade where they're not in a position to go, like, fuck that guy.
Right.
You know, we're hanging the whole investment is hanging on that person.
Right.
I started thinking about this too after when I was watching the doc too, just like, you know, that the systemic tolerance for, you know, not only sexism, but just like insanity.
Yeah.
You know, because of the artist.
Right.
On all levels.
Right.
It's kind of amazing.
It really is. And almost every project has somebody like that, you know.
So the Academy Award, you won that.
Yeah. Yeah. That was fun.
It must have been fun.
It was so shocking.
Was it shocking?
No, you know what happened? I was getting ready. I was so, you know, excited and nervous. And I sat down to eat some spaghetti before going and put on the TV. And it was Oprah's show. And she had, like, Gene Siskel and Rex Reed and all these, you know, reviewers. And they were right at the Best Supporting Actress category when I turned it on. And they're talking about this one. Oh, yeah, she might. Yeah, no, no. Yeah. And then the last one was me, and every single person went, oh, no.
Really?
No chance.
Just what you
I had been thinking, you know, I have a 1 in 5 chance or something.
Yeah.
I was so demoralized. I was like, oh, well,
watching.
I guess I'll still go.
Speculators. that would have done it. I can't go. It's going to be too hard.
Oh, well.
Yeah, but you got it.
And then you got up there.
And you got to get the award.
Oh, no.
In front of everybody. Back then, it was like half the world was watching. Now they can't get anyone to watch or even host the thing.
Oh, my God. Right.
but it still means something, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, it was interesting because it kind of felt like, wow, I got that out of the way, you know, pretty early. And it kind of felt really good. Like, well, I checked off something. And so, yeah.
Now, it seems like in the doc, this changes everything, that, you know, Thelma and Louise represented some sort of pivot point.
Right.
In terms of the industry, you know, having, you know, putting some confidence and faith in female leads.
Right.
Having a female driven movie.
Right.
With specifically female themes.
Right.
Because, you know, throughout the doc and this mission you have with the Gina Davis Institute on Gender and Media. Like that whole part of it, the research that your crew put in to that the whole idea that I think the two areas of, like, in the name of the children to some degree.
Yes.
You know, but also in the name of the, you know, grown-up women who want to work.
Right.
That, you know, the evidence had to be presented.
Exactly.
You know, on this level of, like, you know, how women are depicted in descriptions.
Right.
In scripts.
Yep.
You know, what are women saying and would women say that?
Right.
You know, they're just their screen time in general.
Yep.
You know, and then, you know, behind the camera on the writing level, the directing level, and, you know, all the way down the line.
Yeah.
That, you know, that you had to amass evidence.
Exactly.
of institutional sexism.
Right.
Like, it wasn't enough just to, you know, to spend a day, anybody, watching movies.
Right.
Or television.
Right.
But because of this, you know, kind of institutionalized and cultural sort of habit.
Yes.
Of framing women like this.
Right.
That no one was really, like, other than women, you know, some women were kind of pushing back on it.
Right. Right. Well, what happened is, I mean, I knew what everybody knew, there were fewer female directors and writers and fewer female stars, you know, lead characters and all that stuff. But I like you were saying, that's kind of the way it is or something was my thinking. And then and then when my daughter was a toddler, I started watching kids' things with her, showing her preschool shows and things like that. And I immediately noticed that there seemed to be far more male characters than female characters in what's made for the littlest kids. Teletubbies is gender balanced. I don't know if you can tell. Yeah, but other than that, it seemed to be a big problem. But apropos of what you're saying, I decided first I'm just going to bring it up in when I have meetings with whoever, studio execs or producers, and every single person said, no, that's not true anymore. That's been fixed.
Right.
And I asked dozens and dozens of people this question, and every person said, that's not true anymore.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes they would name a movie with one female character as proof that gender inequality was fixed.
Right.
And so that's when I realized I want to get the data. Because I can't be wrong in what I'm seeing, I don't think. And so that's what I did. And it proved to be absolutely true.
It's fascinating data, you know, that and the sort of work that went into doing it. And also the doc goes into the fact that that wasn't the way it always was.
Right.
And I think that's a kind of a profound piece that in the silent era, there were literally, you know, hundreds of women working in film and directing film and in the production side of film.
Starring.
Starring, of course. And, you know, Mary Pickford was, you know, had her own, United Artists was, she was part of it. Griffith, Chaplin, Fairbanks, and her, maybe one other one. I don't know. I don't remember who was involved. But the primary reason it changed was when the studios were sort of became kind of property of banks, and the corporate structure was less, you know, kind of Wild Westy and more organized along corporate hierarchical lines, which were, you know, intrinsically male.
Right, right.
So the distrust of women or the condescension was, you know, brought in from another business almost.
Right, yep.
It's almost like there was this silent era that, you know, could have been flourished as an artistic, you know, kind of independent world of maybe not so much multicultural at that point, but certainly a gender balanced profession.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you come under the scrutiny of bankers and corporate interests, were men,
right?
And that's when it changed. Like it was actually there was this weird utopic time,
exactly. and not many.
I had no idea.
Right. And there's a few areas you could think of that started out balanced and then got work. You know, usually it's been everything's been male dominated, and then women try to get in.
Yeah, but at the time, it wasn't until they realized this is big money in this that this is the most powerful cultural medium ever harnessed by humans, pulled down from the ether, the celluloid business.
Yes.
We're going to own the brains of everybody.
Right.
And men have got to be in charge of owning brains.
Yes, yes. we have a certain message we want to send.
So did you feel when Thelma and Louise, when you got that script and, you know, you saw, you know, the impact it could have, what were all these issues pressing at that point? Is that when it began to sort of become apparent that this was going to be a breakthrough movie, and you were aware of the issues at that time?
No. And nobody involved in it had any idea the nerve that it was going to strike or had that as a goal.
Yeah.
I just thought it was the best script I'd ever read. And it was unusual in that it had two female leads, and I couldn't decide which part I wanted to play, but anyway. And it wasn't until the movie came out. I mean, we were literally thinking, we hope somebody sees this movie, you know. And, it seemed like a smallish movie, pretty low budget, certainly for a Ridley Scott movie. When it exploded like that, we were stunned. It was amazing. And very impactful, because it wasn't just that people were talking about it and it made money and all that, but it was so different when I ran into somebody who recognized me from that movie than before. People would say, I liked Beetlejuice or whatever.
Right.
Now they wanted to talk about it and tell me, you know, who they saw it with and how many times they saw it and, you know, what it meant to them and how it changed their life. Or, you know, sometimes people would say, my friend and I acted out your trip.
Yeah,
like, I'd be like, which part? Really?
Well, there's a few people dead.
Yeah. And, yeah.
But also I think that, you know, in thinking about it in light of, you know, the information, mm-hmm. you know, they were fully, you know, realized female characters because a woman wrote it.
Right, right, exactly.
That there are things that happen in that movie that are specifically, you know, so intimate and in related to the female experience,
right,
that they were beyond the conception of a man, really.
I can agree with that.
You know, because I started to think about those scenes, you know, yeah. like, and the horrible sadness of whatever Susan went through, which, right. you know, sort of remains unspoken.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you're kind of falling for Brad Pitt, who wouldn't, given your predicament
right.
of the crazy, weird, tightly wrapped, toxic husband.
Right,
you
right.
know, and this is the first time that you, and then the money, it's just like, and how you reacted to that was specifically from a woman's point of view.
Yes, yes.
And it would not have worked in any other way.
Right. Right. You're right. Stuff that's in there probably wouldn't have been there if a man had written it, right?
Right. So when does the kind of like, you know, obviously you talk to some directors, I don't remember their names, who, you know, obviously there were plenty of women in Hollywood realizing the problem.
Right.
Before, you know, Thelma and Louise and, uh-huh. you know, going way back, you know, these fights had been fought before.
Right.
You know, you go into, there's a couple arcs in the movie. Yeah, but the one of the major through lines is the DGA.
Yes.
The Directors Guild and those directors.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of happened politically in a show business way, you know, after Thelma and Louise around the issues that are now kind of at the forefront?
Well, the interesting phenomenon I noticed was that all the press about it said that now everything is going to be different, you know, because this movie had, right. you know, had such an impact.
Women can carry a movie.
Yes, women can carry a movie, and we're going to see so much more of that now. And then the very next movie I made was League of Their Own, where people said the same thing. Now there's going to be so many more female sports movies because it's been proven that there's an appetite for that. And then none of that happened. You know, I think the thought was from everybody that things really would start to change.
People yeah, because would, like, you know, we did what they all wanted to do. We made money.
Right. We made money.
So, you know, how could it, like, it's good.
Big hit. That's yeah. great. Yeah, let's copy that. Actually, Callie Corey, the writer, told me a story that she had a writer friend of hers that was 3 years later was pitching a movie to some studio. And it had also happened to have two female stars, but it had nothing else to do with Thelma and Louise. And they said, no, there's been Thelma and Louise. Like, it was almost like, now we can't have movies anymore with two female leads because it's been done. It was just the craziest thing. And then, you know, what I noticed was every few years a movie would come out starring women, and everybody would latch onto that and say, okay, well, now we're done. Now things are done and it's all changed. And it absolutely didn't.
So this sort of reflexive reaction of a male-dominated business was we threw them the bone.
Yeah.
And, you know, that should placate them for a while.
Right. And that they're a fluke, that they're always a one-off, that you can never get any momentum going because everybody says, yeah, but, you know, that we can't trust that that will happen. Because I felt like, you know, realized that Hollywood seemed to be run on the idea that women will watch men, but men won't watch women. So everything we do has to be based on that fact. And it includes girls will watch boys, but boys won't watch girls. So everything had to be male dominated. And if there was a fluky, you know, instance where a girl was the lead, but we still have to stick to our formula.
Yeah, because it's what people expect.
Right.
I guess the thing that struck me that was interesting is that, you know, what's being presented here is logical. It's logical and it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the paradigm that exists, you know, these are men that don't think they're bad men.
Oh, right.
Yeah. You know, so like they just can't get the brain pop.
Right.
that makes them see how stilted it is,
right?
Or that it is fundamentally, discriminating,
right? Right.
Because it's always been the way it's been.
Yes.
And that's sort of a weird thing to me, because like you're dealing with, you know, thousands of years of history. It's almost genetic.
Yep. Yeah.
But the switch that has to be thrown is a fairly simple one to throw.
Yeah.
And once it's like, you know, once men realize it, what they do at that crossroads really determines,
right,
are you going to commit to being this kind of person,
mm-hmm,
or are you going to be a monster?
Are you going to consciously support, instead of unconscious, having it be unconscious discrimination, are you going to now consciously discriminate?
Right. It's sort of like, you know, once you go to AA and you get sober, if you start drinking again, you still got a head full of AA.
Right.
Saying like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Yeah.
So, and if you're saying like, you know, shut the fuck up, I'm doing what I want to do.
Right.
Then, you know, you got personal problems to reckon with.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
And there's a lot of people that have personal problems to reckon with.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think people don't realize how much unconscious gender bias we all have, and particularly men. I think you could say, well, I know I don't have gender bias. You know, I have friends who are women, but we all have it. Men and women have it, and it's perhaps genetic by now. But the popular culture is reinforcing it every minute. From the second you start consuming popular culture, you're seeing that men are more important than women, and you just take it in. You don't even have to realize, well, that's, you know, like there's no little girl who says, I'm not seeing myself fairly represented up there. I should.
Yeah, and also then the sexualizing that happens in women.
Right.
Yeah, to themselves in order to do what they think is necessary to function in the world.
Exactly. But don't you feel like this industry thinks of itself as this separate thing? Well, we're a creative community. It's different. We don't have to we have to make decisions based on creative process rather than what's fair or right, you know.
I think so, but I also think that, you know, really on the bigger level, it's big money.
Yeah.
And like, you know, it seems like now, you know, whether progress has been made in a mainstream way, that, you know, more people are making things of different, you know, ethnic groups and, you know, sexual orientation and gender, mm-hmm, but you know, it doesn't get the support of a larger movie. But that's true with a lot of things in the movie business. And I think that, you know, right now, like, I guess they're all pretty excited that they've, you know, successfully, they being the executives, is that, you know, we've integrated the Marvel Universe. And, you know, so that's all that matters culturally and on the bottom line level.
Right.
But so the disappointment of Thelma and Louise and the momentum that happened after that was that it did just recede back into its standard format.
Right. Exactly. I mean, it changed me tremendously. It was kind of the start of all my awakening. And
League of Their Own, Thelma and Louise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. A very powerful 1-2 punch. And it made me, what it made me realize was how few opportunities we give women to come out of a movie feeling inspired and empowered by the female characters. And that's kind of the best part of watching a movie, is you get to identify with somebody and you live vicariously through them. And it just made me sick to think about women being robbed of that experience.
Right,
you know?
of seeing themselves in things.
Right.
You know, people of color as well. And
absolutely.
And it just, like, yeah, because when you really think about how important TV and movies are,
mm-hmm,
you know, music's a little different because, you know, it seems like really everyone's pretty well represented in music.
Yeah.
You can find your own way there.
Right.
But in these in the stories that the culture tells,
mm-hmm,
you know, that there's one point in the doc where someone says, you know, a black woman is like, do I even exist?
Oh, yeah, I know.
Right?
I know. Right.
And I don't know that, again, that like I don't know that I put that much in my own mind intellectually, that much emphasis on the reflection that movies provide.
Right.
You know, I just, you know, I understand the issues, But I never really, you know, extended my empathy to, like, you know, I don't know if right. I'm really represented in movies, but certainly I identify and I can latch on to a character
sure.
as my guy.
Right.
But that's just it, is my guy.
Right.
Do women have their woman?
Right, right.
You know, not usually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of times, if there's an ensemble of, like, let's say there's six and there's one woman, I think as a sort of trying to placate women or feminists or whatever, you know, she's very tough. She's the toughest one. And yeah. she's the not funny one.
Right, right. And that's written in the description of the script.
Yeah, yeah. She's tough as nails. And there's even, I noticed a bunch of kids movies, animated kids movies, where there'd be like four main characters and one is a woman. And they cast somebody who's not a comic. You know, all the other guys are
hilarious.
Ben Stiller or Chris Rock, yeah. and she's the wet blanket.
The bitch character.
Yeah, the one. Come on, you guys.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, going back to your career, so when you do, what happened after Cutthroat Island, you know, that, you know, in relation to, because, like, you know, in the information about you, and I don't know how you see it, That sort of, you know, they kind of hung the sort of failure of that movie on you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that?
Let me think. I know there's been a lot of talk about what a big failure it was.
But do you think?
I don't know that I saw so much that people said, "Oh, it's a failure because it was a woman instead of a man."
Yeah.
People were certainly very eager to. Jump on that, yeah.
And that was Rennie Harlan,
right?
Who you were with at that time?
Yes.
That must have made things difficult.
Yeah. I was. we were able to commiserate with each other, but you know, because we put a lot of effort and passion into that.
Sure.
And then the next movie we made was Long Kiss Goodnight, which got a much better
That did all right
reception.
At the box office.
It did
office.
All right, yeah, yeah.
But did you feel that there was a shift in your career, you know, after those movies, you know, that was particularly because you were a woman?
Well, yeah, there was a shift for sure, and it was right around when I turned 40, let's think. Yeah, I think I turned 40 sort of right after Long Kiss Goodnight. And so, you know, I had thought from the beginning that it wasn't going to happen to me, you know.
Yeah,
that,
right.
Because when I was starting out was when Meryl Streep was winning, you know, French Lieutenant's Woman and Glenn Close and all those women, Sally Field, were having these fabulous movies every year. And I thought, well, they're fixing everything. I don't have to worry. And what happened to me was I was averaging about a movie a year, and I was being very fussy about what I said yes to until I was 40. And then from when I was 40 to 50, I made one movie.
But you did a lot of TV.
I did some, I didn't do a lot of TV. I did some TV. Yeah.
Was that when did the Gina Davis show happen?
That was right. That was about when I was 41, I think. Yeah. And then when I was 50, I got, Commander in Chief.
Got to be the president.
I got to be the president. I had a short administration,
but it was a one season administration.
Yeah. But that was really demoralizing. I mean, it wasn't that I wasn't offered anything, but nothing that, you know, that spoke to me or that I wanted to play. It was just completely different all of a sudden, you know. And so my theory is, from examining this a great deal, is that people think of having a female character when it needs to be female, like she's the girlfriend of somebody or the wife or whatever, and that's going to tend to be somebody younger, and then so for characters that could be either, nobody's thinking about that. They just, you know, the default is always male. So if it's the 50-year-old boss or the whatever, or even the best friend of the character, of course, male. And if they stop to think about it, they could realize, and this is what I talk about when I meet with studios, look at all the characters and see which ones you can turn into female, because it doesn't make any difference. If they're not having sex with somebody, it doesn't matter if it's a male or female. And that's why I think so many women over 40 are not working is because people aren't being creative enough and thinking, well, wait a minute, why couldn't this be a woman? You know?
Right, and you would think that these men in their 40s and 50s, who's at this point, you know, I would assume their wives are involved in things and doing things in life. And
right.
Their daughters are doing things in life.
And right.
They might have some friendly relationships with women that are non-sexual and whatnot.
Right, exactly.
But it's still that, it's a paradigm thing.
It
still.
Is.
You're
it
up
is.
Against this, you know, this, the way it always has been.
Right.
Still.
And unconscious bias. And, you know,
unconscious
it's just
bias,
so easy
guess,
to default to male. You just don't think of it.
Well, but it's interesting too, like, you know, there's I had a conversation with somebody about this kind of idea that, you know, and this is something I see as a dude, and I think that it happens a lot on all levels, in front of the camera, writing, directing,
mm-hmm.
is that, you know, now that things are kind of publicly and culturally shifting, and you know, and the industry is aware and I think trying to do something about it,
mm-hmm.
is you get a bunch of white dudes going like, well, I couldn't get the job because they're only hiring women.
Oh,
or,
my
I couldn't
God.
Get the job because they only want black people. I couldn't
oh
get the job.
God.
Yeah,
it's right. It's true.
And but see, the fundamental fault in that is interesting because, you know, the system, given the way it is that, you know, men on all levels, no matter how shitty they are at their job,
right.
if they can do them, even if they're just hackers,
right.
you know, they're going to get the job.
Right.
Right? Because that's just the way the system is built up. So these guys who claim that, like, it's not about whether you can do the job or not.
Right.
That's the fallacy.
Right.
It's like a lot of people have to realize, like, well, maybe you weren't doing it that good. What's happening is it's become... You know, with equality right. on some level and less discrimination, it becomes more competitive because you have a whole world of people that are fucking great at it
yeah.
that have been denied the opportunity. And now, you know, your shoddy little resume is not going to stand up on the new field.
Right, right.
It's not that it's being stilted in any way. It's just become more competitive because they've entered, there's a whole other world of talent coming in.
Right, right.
So these guys who were complaining anyways about their place in the world and why couldn't they get their own show on the air, whatever it is.
Right.
You know, now they can hang it on this.
Yes. Yeah. It's amazing how many people, men, think that way, that now they only want black women. Or say, well, really? Let's look at the numbers. How right. many black... Is it really that more than 50% of the people working now are black women?
But the assumption that that's the only requirement
right.
is really...
Exactly.
That's not like unconscious bias.
Right.
I mean, or unconscious racism.
Right.
That's bias because you don't take it to the next step, which is like, maybe that person's completely qualified, has an
right.
interesting vision,
right.
you know, is better than you at the job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, they didn't even want those possibilities to enter the conversation.
Right, right.
They stop at black, they stop at women, they stop at gay.
Right, right. Exactly, exactly. You know, my theory is that the easiest thing to change is the on-screen representation because
yeah.
I really feel like that's unconscious for the most part, that's unconscious bias. People don't realize they're doing it. Just from my experience and how the data makes all the difference, that they say, what are we doing?
Right, sure,
really?
Right.
Is that, but that behind the camera, it's conscious bias because everybody's known those numbers for decades. Everybody's been completely aware, and it does nothing, knowing the numbers does nothing to make anybody say, let's
say,
do better.
Right. Well, I'm guilty of it. I mean, I had a show. I'm sad that my mind is so blown by all this, but it's good.
Right.
Well, what are you finding now? Like, you know, when you're, and I don't know how recent those experiences of you telling what you're telling to studio people.
Right.
Yeah, we changed that. Now, are you finding a shift in that? Because in the doc, you know, the 2018 numbers for directorial employment
right.
Were still pretty, they were low.
Oh, yeah. No, nothing is improving as far as behind the camera. And directors, it does nothing but kind of go down and maybe, you know, it's always single digits. And there's, you can't even say, well, in 500 years we'll be equal, because there's no progress whatsoever. So, like I said, that's a big problem that's going to take people making very conscious decisions. I'm doing a bad job, and I'm going to do better by being very conscious of it and taking these steps. You can't just think I'm hiring. I don't think anybody could say I hire based on merit if they haven't made conscious, proactive steps to overcome their unconscious bias. Like, you can't say, I'm so woke, all I do is make my decisions based on merit.
I think that, again, it stops at that thing that there's this sort of idea that this is all some kind of expansion of affirmative action. You know, that, you know, that they're not looking past the idea of, like, you know, well, how many women are there? We got to get women in here. As opposed to, like, what is the full expanse of people that are capable of doing this?
Yeah.
And I want to see the resumes of women, people of color, and, you know, and the regular white guys.
Right.
And so, you know, if we're going to, you know, start to integrate this decision-making process, let's see the full pool of talent.
Exactly.
Not like, you know, well, we're required.
Yes.
To get one of those ladies in there.
Yeah, so when I was in Australia a couple of years ago, they told me about this short film competition, very well known there. And every year, only about 17% of the films that are chosen for the competition are directed by women. And a couple of years ago, they had the thought, you know what, let's just try taking the names off of these movies. So nobody knows whether a man or a woman directed it. Straight to 50-50. So, and these are people who were trying to do a good job. You know, I really want to make sure we're fair.
Yeah.
And they had to take the names off. So it just shows how deep it is and how you can't just think your way out of it. You have
Yeah. And also, you know, I'm talking to men. It's like, okay, look, we've all been assholes. You know, I certainly have, you know, and I've talked about it at length, and I've you know, had to reckon with myself around a lot of it, but it is sort of on us,
you know,
that now that the push is there and the awareness is there,
right?
It is on us.
Yeah.
You're struggling against, you know, a history of manness,
right?
And your own stubbornness.
Right.
And your own, you know, unchecked bias, that is just intrinsic.
Right.
So, like, it is an active struggle, and I think a lot of dudes,
right,
who are, and it's a struggle within themselves,
right,
and to sort of step out, you know, and sort of take the hit of like, you know, dug in douchebags going, look at the virtue signaling, you know, white knighting fuck. Cuck, I don't know. I'm a grown ass man. I'm 55 years old. I'm not going to talk to you like a comic book character. And, you know, it's like, you know, you can be the way you want to be, but, you know, it's our responsibility as evolved people to do this.
Right. Well, you know, John Landgraf, it was when he heard the data, when he heard the numbers about how he was doing and how low they were ranked, that he decided he was going to do something about it. And so...
Bottom line.
So, like you're saying, once you know that, you got to do something about it.
Right. And also, it's sort of like, if this helps, you know, it's sort of like there's money in these women.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, movies starring women have made more money at the box office for the last few years. In 2017, they made 38% more money at the box office. If there was a female lead character. So,
well, that's good. But on some level, it's because it's exciting and new.
Exactly. Exactly. You know what I was going to tell you that I've never really talked about is, so we meet with everybody, every union and guild and whatever, but...
This is with your institute?
With my institute, yes. But we had never spoken to anybody at the Directors Guild. And so the woman who, my CEO, was constantly calling them and trying to, can Gina speak to the DGA? And at first they said, no, she's too controversial. Really? Adding more women is too controversial. Okay. But she kept calling and trying different people and whatever. And then they said, oh, we don't let anybody who's not in the union speak to the union. And then we find out that's not true. Of course, they have lots of people come in. And then finally, a year later, they call and say, guess what? We are going to let Gina come and speak to the DGA, but only to the women. In 2013, they said out loud, Gina can only speak to the women directors, who I don't need to talk to.
Yeah.
You know, obviously. And but I went anyway to this conference and I said, I don't need to be talking to you guys. And they were like, we know.
And that was 2013.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where are we at now with that?
I don't know. I haven't been back. I haven't yet talked to, you know, had an opportunity to speak to the male directors as a group. But it's a big problem. All I'm talking about is add more female characters. That's all I wanted to say. Hey, by the way, add more female characters. Or, you know, cast women in some of the men's parts.
Or let them direct. It wasn't about even directing?
No, it was, you're the director. Here's what you can do for on-screen representation.
Given, you know, your visibility in the industry, have you found any receptive or actively supportive men in these different areas of business as you have these meetings or like directors? Or I mean, you know everybody.
Right, right. That's why I thought that the thing to do with the research was to go directly to the creators. You know, I don't have to get the public aroused and have them demand, you know, whatever. I could just go very quietly and privately in a very friendly and collegial way and say, I don't think you knew this. What do you think? And the reaction has always been, oh, my God, what are we doing? And that they want to change it. And obviously, I'm mostly talking to men because they're the ones that are the decision makers and most of the writers and most of the producers and all that and directors. So, but they're very receptive to it. And I think part of it is that I'm talking about what kids see first. And people that make kids entertainment do it because they love kids. And so they're
pretty receptive,
horrified yeah. to find out what they're doing. And
out of habit.
Yes, yes, without even realizing it. And that's why I knew I needed the data, because none of them realized it without that. So so we're actually making progress as far as on-screen representation goes. And like I said, that's the lowest hanging fruit. That's the absolute easiest thing to change. And I think it will change dramatically within, you know, 10 years.
It's just so like, you know, and I have one. It's kind of amazing how fragile the male ego is, because like so much of this.
When you said I have one, you meant a male ego?
Yeah. you know, but a lot of it, you know, that is the, you know, day-to-day individual autonomous face of this thing or in these vessels that are manifestations of this ego that is threatened, fundamentally threatened by women.
And why do you think that is?
I'm trying to think right now.
Right. In other words, why would, I don't dispute what you're saying, but what makes a male ego so fragile when you're the guys
because I think not unlike what we're talking about, it is built on the history of dominance.
Right.
So,
oh, okay.
You know, even in mundane situations, you know, I imagine even, you know, in situations where the power dynamic is you know, limited,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, even in a relationship,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, there's the part of the male ego that's sort of like, you know, you don't manipulate me, you know, I'm better at you than this, you know, I'm a man.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm not going to cry. You know, I don't need to show that part of me to you.
Right.
You know, I'm a man. You know, and don't try to get it out of me, lady.
Right. Right.
You know, yeah. Like I think that the wiring of the male ego is built on the same foundation as all these problems.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how, you know, as a person you're sitting across from, you know, that's how it's going to reveal itself,
right?
Right. It's based on that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But like, you know, in trying to open up to a more vulnerable place. Yeah, I have to assume it's fairly emotionally infantile. you know, that reaction, you know, to be threatened like that.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows that where it comes from in a lot of individuals, but
right.
to sort of put yourself forward and live in the vulnerability or at least untether yourself from that, you know, male dominated paradigm is like weird and new and scary.
Right.
And you feel like you might be, you know, just, you know, cry or get beaten somehow, you know? So like
right.
to sort of like, you know, wade into that pool.
Yeah.
You know, it's sadly a lot to ask of some dudes.
Right. Right.
You know, because it's scary on an existential level.
Right. Right. Yeah. Everything you thought was right might not be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. In terms of work now, do you feel like you're working enough? Well, you're busy with this stuff, which is important.
Busy with that stuff, which is important, but it's not my day job. You
yeah,
know,
yeah.
I would definitely work much more if the stuff was there.
Do you like doing, like, when you, because I know, like, as I talk to actors, there's a lot of things that you do that you know going in, it's not going to be the greatest thing, but you're going to do the best you can. You know, like, I assume that there are some acting jobs. Well, this show is like, I don't know how it's going to go. Or like this movie, like, it could be good. I'm not sure it's out of my, it's in my control, but I you know, I like the part.
Oh.
Well, you don't have to, I mean.
Well, you know, I've been.
Lucky.
I've been really lucky in that, frankly, I haven't run out of money yet.
Right, right.
You know, okay. I always say I can only be this choosy because I can afford to wait.
Sure.
And someday I'll be in some horrible movie or be in something that said, oh, I don't know how this is going to work out. But
usually
I hope
good.
It's okay.
You like
but
it.
Usually it's not that I think, oh, this is going to be successful, but I love the part and I love the director and it seems like a great idea and, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
And Stuart Little was fun.
Yeah, it was. It was really fun.
People loved those.
People loved them, yeah.
Kids?
That was fun.
It must be nice to do kid stuff.
It is. It is. It's fun to have little kids recognize you.
Yeah?
Yeah, it is.
They get all excited.
They do. They do. Although they
that you're a real person?
Yeah. But they stare at me a lot because I don't look exactly like I did before. And,
right,
and
right.
So they're like, wow, I think that's Mrs. Little, but is it really? But one of the most fun parts is talking to girls or young women that play sports because of League of Their Own. That's really fun.
I know. That was great in the documentary that, like, you know, that's a whole other sort of result of that movie that you couldn't anticipate.
No,
like, I got into sports, you know.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Well, you're doing great work. I certainly liked working with you on GLOW.
I loved working with you, yeah.
I'm excited for that to come out.
Yep.
And thanks for, being part of my education. Seriously.
Really?
I don't know how much, you know. Are you a producer on the doc?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I am.
So, yeah, thank you.
Okay. All right.
Good
thank
talking you.
To you. That was fun.
Gina Davis. I love her. I love her. Everybody loves her. But I just talked to her. The documentary, This Changes Everything, will have a one-night-only showing across the country tonight, July 22nd, before going into theaters. And on demand on August 9th, you can see her in GLOW Season 3. And she's also going to win. Is it a winning thing? She is being honored with the Jean Hirschhalt Humanitarian Award by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences at this year's Governor's Award Ceremony. I'm going to play some meditative guitar that has a tinge of sadness to it. Okay? All right? It was 400 degrees on the nose in Boise, Idaho. And it was raining sideways and hailing. But that's just the way it is now.
Boomer lives.
Hey, folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here. And when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.